We are back in Parshat Vayira. The primary thing that I want to recap from last time, because it's what we're going to really be focusing on using what we learned last time, is the structure of the Parsha, the oddities in the structure of the Parsha, and that's really what we're going to tackle, even in just this one. I would say short shir, but we all know that's never going to happen, so in this one shir, full stop. Okay, so what was our outline from last time? What's the outline of Parshat Vayira? For those two of you who have chumashim, please take them out. And let's take a look and come back to, or if you took notes last time, what's the outline of Parshat Vayira? What do we have? What's the first thing?
The
Ptikha. The Ptikha, right. What we call just the opening paragraph. Because it's totally unclear what the topic of this opening paragraph is. It's this long opening paragraph, which has many different topics in it. It has, which we said, are defined by the malachim that come. That we have one malach, there are three malachim who come. One malach comes to heal Abraham. One malach comes to tell of the birth of Yitzchak. And then one malach comes to destroy stone. And then we said it was either Michael or Raphael doubled up on his tafkid, even though they're not supposed to. Doubled up on his tafkid and then went and saved Lot. But we have, what do these things have to do with each other? These are all part of this one huge opening paragraph. There should have been one paragraph that dealt with the Besara of Yitzchak, the telling of the coming of Yitzchak, and a totally separate paragraph dealing with stone. Why is this one long paragraph? And it was the same question. Why send these malachim as a group of three? It's the same question. If they all have an individual unique tafkid and their tafkidim are totally different, they don't send them as a group. Send two malachim to go and heal Abraham and tell of the birth of Yitzchak, and then send a separate malach, or two malachim to go and destroy Sodom and save Lot. But the fact that these are all in one paragraph, and the fact that these malachim come as a group of three, indicate to us that there must be one unified concept within this paragraph, that somehow all of these issues come together. We're going to have to address that directly today. Good. That was paragraph number one. What's topic number two? Yeah, Avimelech. What we called Avimelech 1 of 2. What was weird about Avimelech 1? What happens in Avimelech 1? It's the seemingly, on the surface, a lot of the details is the exact same story that we saw already when Avraham had to go down to Mitzrayim at the beginning of Parshat Lech Lecha. So why are we repeating this story of Avraham going to a strange land where he's afraid of the people there, so therefore he tells Sarah to pretend that she's his sister, where the king ends up taking her, then freaks out, realizes he shouldn't have done that, and then returns Sarah to Avraham and everybody's happy. The end. Why are we going through this again, just with Avimelech instead of Parah? Why are we repeating the story of Mitzrayim with Avimelech? Question on Avimelech 1. Then we have
Yitzchak.
Finally, Yitzchak is born, and we have Birur Yishmael, and finally Yishmael is selected away. We're going to develop it a little bit more today as well, but the two already making sense happening at the same time, because we have the birth of Yitzchak, and therefore that is exactly the time that we can select away Yishmael, because he is not the selected child to continue on the legacy and the line, the lineage of Avraham, to be the carrier of the bracha of Avraham, to be passed down to eventually create Bnei Israel. Our question here was, in our opening we had the Bisara of Yitzchak, which made sense. I want to reemphasize the question that we asked last time, and that we asked 3 times ago, and 4 times ago, and 5 times ago. Which is, once we get past Brit Ben Abitarim in Lech Lecha, what should happen immediately after the promise that Avram is going to have children who will inherit Eretz Yisrael? Yitzchak. So it doesn't happen. First we get Yishmael. We explain Yishmael at length. Great! Now what should happen?
Yitzchak.
And that's what we're told. The Malachim are going to say, who's coming? And what happens next? Lots of other stuff. Why is Stone in between? Let alone in the same paragraph. Why is Stone in between? Why is Avimelech in between? These two stories should have been back to back, and they should have been right after we've been up at Tarim. So Yishmael, I understand, but what is Stone doing in the middle here? What is Avimelech doing in the middle here? But at least he was born. At this point, we're happy to see it happen. Or I'm starting to get nervous. We got promises of Parsha, a whole Parsha ago. Half of Vayera and half of Lech Lecha. What happens after we finally get Yitzchak? What we called Avimelech 2. What happens at Avimelech 2? We have the Shrua with the Sheva Kvasot at Be'er Sheva, which is screaming out to say, what is the connection between sevens and Shruas and Be'er Sheva? And also, what is this doing in the Farsha? And also, why is Avimelech 1 and Avimelech 2 divided by the birth of Yitzchak? Which is further emphasized by the fact that what happens right after Abimelech too? We come right back to Yitzchak for the most important part of his story, which is
Akedah Yitzchak.
Now we can link in the issues that we discussed last time, the topics we discussed last time, is that what's so significant about Akedah Yitzchak focusing with the emphasis on Yitzchak? It was literally the topic of last year. The full emergence of the Midah of Gvura. Yitzchak is the embodiment of the Midah of Gvura. It comes out in its totality on Akedat Yitzchak, that one element of the multifaceted Midah of Gvura is self-cancellation. The ultimate self-cancellation is Mesiras Nefesh, and he who embodies Mesiras Nefesh, as we saw both in theory, and then we saw literally stated in the Midrash, Bechol Nefshecha Ki Yitzchak at the Akedah, that's Yitzchak himself. And this is the moment where he embodies Mesiras Nefesh, embodies one, is bringing out one facet in its fullest of the Midah of Gvura. So how this parsha should be sliced down to like a third. Parshat Vayera, which deals with the concept of sight, but also the Midah of Yirat Shamayim, the Midah of Gvura, the birth of Yitzchak, much simpler, a much shorter parsha, we can get out of shul much faster. Let's just, let's bring the parsha to the chopping block and let's just leave behind the Besorah of Yitzchak, the birth of Yitzchak, we'll leave in the separation of Yishmael, and then just go straight to Akedas Yitzchak, done, Kiddush. Maybe we'll throw in Musaf. Right? Maybe. See. We're cutting things out. May as well cut out more. Kiddush faster. Yeah.
What's the first one?
What's the first one? I just wrote Tikha, the opening paragraph. It's not even the opening, it's literally the opening paragraph. I don't have a title for it.
If you want to call it Yitzchak, this zone you can,
though it's just a really weird thing to, it's like Isaac and the really bad place that got destroyed in fiery brimstone. Like, what do those things have to do with each other?
You want
to
call it the Gimel Malachim?
You can call it that also, but it raises the same questions. We don't have a definitive title. We don't know what's happening there yet. That's what we're going to try to unpack today. We clear on the fundamental questions in the structure of the Parsha? So again, using the concept of the fact that the Midah of Gvura is clearly what's coming out in this parsha that we talked about last time. And we said the Midah of Gvura comes out in its fullest all the way at the end of the parsha in Akedat Yitzchak. What that implies is, in the same way, it's the same logic that we used when Yishmael came before the promise of Yitzchak, is that if Yitzchak only comes later in the parsha, and if Yitzchak only comes out in the fullness of his Midah later in the Parsha, then somehow all of this is a necessary prerequisite in order for Yitzchak and the Midah of Gvura to come out. The question is why and how, and that's what we're going to address. Let's come back to a figure who we continue to try to ignore and try to get rid of, but keeps coming back and keeps proving his deep significance in the context of the history of Klal Yisrael and the narrative of Sefer Bereishit. I am, of course, referring to the individual of Lot. Right? The guy you didn't think we were going to talk so much about in the Chumash Shirim, right? In our Bereishit Shirim. Lot keeps coming back. We have the telling of the coming of Yitzchak in the opening paragraph, which immediately transitions into the decision to destroy stone, the argument between Avraham and HaKadosh Baruch Hu not to destroy stone, which is unsuccessful. God does go forward and destroy stone. And then Lot is the only one who is saved. Lot leaves with his daughters and his wife. They don't even all make it. Who doesn't make it? His wife doesn't make it. She's told not to
look
back. Parshat Vayera, don't look back. She looks back. She turns to a pillar of salt, whatever that's about. And then they go on. And that's the end of the story, right? No. I would say, what's the end of the story? But I'll be the one who has to say it. Okay, what's the end of the story? The end of the story is very complicated, right? The end of the story is very uncomfortable. But the end of the story is very important. Which is that Lot and his daughters manage to escape, narrowly escape, so much so Lot begs the Malachim to leave one of the places unharmed, so that way he doesn't have to even run as far, so he can just get out to a place that's safe. Lot's daughters seem to have not been keyed in on exactly what was happening. And Lot's daughters thought that when they saw the destruction of Sodom and Amorah, the five cities that made up that entire area, they thought that they were witnessing the end of the world. They literally, like, that's not an exaggeration, they literally thought that they were witnessing the end of the world. And so something frightening happens, which is Lot's daughters make the incredibly difficult decision that in their mind, the only way for the world not to end is to continue on the world through their father. And so the first night after the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah, one of them has a relationship with her father, which produces one nation, one person becomes a nation, and one of them, the next night has a relationship with her father, which produces another nation, and those nations are Moab and Ammon. Produces Moab and Ammon.
Moab was the first.
Correct. I believe so. I can double check on the screen, but I believe so. Moab and Ammon. Why, we've talked about this before, why is Lot so significant? Why do we care about Lot? Because he's carrying the genes of Mashiach. Who in this story is going to be the carrier of the genes of Mashiach? Moab. This is how Moab is produced. Now, first of all, just in parentheses, it's crazy that Moab, who's going to produce Ruth, who's going to produce David, is coming out through this story. A story which seems deplorable, which seems disgusting. And yet, a pasuk we're going to come back to at the end of Shir as well, if you take a look on the other side of your source sheet, incredible source. Take a look in source number 5. I put it at the end because we're going to come back around to it. There's a pasuk in Tehillim which says, Matzati David Avdi, I found David my servant. And incredibly, the Medrash says at the end of source number 6 in the underline, Amar Yitzchak, Matzati David Avdi, Heichan, where did I find David? When HaKadosh Baruch Hu said I found David, where did I find David? Mitzativ b'Sodom. That's where I found David. But some of the story of Sodom is producing David HaMelech, so much of that the Pesukim and the Midrashim are going and they want to link back to Sodom. Mary pointed out something very powerful. We've talked about this in the past as well, which is how significant the mindset is of the parents at the moment of conception. That the mindset of the parents at the moment of conception has a tremendous impact, Alpini Star, on the quality of the soul that comes down from Shemayim. What was the mindset of the daughters of Lot during the moment of conception? No, it wasn't. Go deeper than that. That gets you wonderful children. What were they thinking at that moment? What was their motivation? Deep down, go dig deeper than that. I would reframe it in saying their goal was to save the human race, was the salvation of the human race. And that's what eventually produces David HaMelech, Mashiach ben David, who he himself is going to be the salvation of the human race. It's incredible insight, the power of the mindset that nobody would ever do such a thing. That what they did with their father, though unclear whether Lot was or was not aware of what was going on, for sure, in terms of his daughters, the goal was the salvation of humanity, and from that, the depth of that Mesirat Nefesh, that sacrifice, as twisted as it may have been, but the motivations within the context of that relationship from their perspective was to save the human race. And that's why even from that place of darkness and that place of distortion is able to come forth David, who he himself, Mashiach itself, is going to be able to find light in the greatest places of darkness. Very powerful concept. But the story of Sodom... Yeah, you had a question first.
But David is one of the hundreds of descendants that come from Ammon and Moab. We don't think very highly of the rest of them.
And yet, somewhere in those genes from Lot to Moab, and then all the way down to David, that's got to carry through. The same way when we talk about Mitzrayim, we look back all the way to Ham. And when we talk about Canaan, we look all the way back to Ham. We keep looking back all the way to what are the roots, the genetic origins.
Similarities in all the layers.
No, we it took us. We spent 10 generations selecting everybody away from Shem until it got to Abraham. And again, we're going to come back to this point at the end of this year. But it means that somewhere in there, and again, the Midrash is intentionally picking up on this. Matzati David Avdi B'Sodom. Where did I begin to find David? In the context of Sodom. That's screaming out to be understood. How is it coming out of that story? And we're going to build that now. Last question that I want to give us. We don't have enough information yet to even be asking questions. Yeah.
It has to be about one. It doesn't matter.
Has to do with?
It doesn't matter.
It does matter.
Okay. If the Midrash is saying that Hashem found David from Sodom, then why did Abraham have to be saying the whole entire time?
I mean, Abraham in this situation, it's not so clear that he was the one to necessarily even save Sodom in this particular instance. In the previous time, it was Maaseh Avot Siman Labanim that he saved that he saved Lot from the four Malachim, meaning that we're going to fight through the Dalai Malchus in order to produce Mashiach. Here, it doesn't seem like Avram was even successful. It's not clear. You could say that he was successful, that Lot wouldn't have been, that Lot would not have been saved had it not been for Avram's tefillas. But either way, then you could say that yes, it's the tefillas of Avram and his children who are going to bring about Mashiach. Like we saw in the Midrash in Bereishit Rabbah at the beginning, Tov, Avo, Vechoshach, Alvei Tov, Ruach Elokim, Rachavet Al Panei Amayim, that the Ruchosh of Mashiach is going to come from Shifchi Kamayim Libeich, is going to come from the Tshuva, the Tefillah of Klal Yisrael. However you want to look at it, whether you want to look at it as being disconnected or Maaseh Avot Siman L'Manim, it all works. But let's get into our issue. Let's jump in. Okay? What it means, one layer of what it means, that we're going through this whole story of stone before we get to Yitzchak. It means that we're making sure to begin to produce the genes of David HaMelech before we go on to produce the second Midah. The second individual is going to be the carrier of the second Midah of Gvura. Somehow we need to produce the beginnings of David HaMelech first. Before we can go on to develop the first Midah and for it to give birth to the second Midah in the system of the seven Midot, we need to plant the seeds to create the possibility for the system to complete itself by the end of the process in the Midah of David HaMelech, in the Midah of Malchut. Before we go from Midah to Midah, from Midah 1 to Midah 2, and begin to develop the system, we're first going to jump ahead to the completion of that system and set the stage for that before we go forward. Right? Because David HaMelech is the carrier of that seventh Midah. He's the carrier of Malchut. He's the individual who brings Malchut out into the world. And so what the story is telling us is that we need to plant the seeds, we need to set the stage, we need to create we need to create a reality where the end point of that system, the goal of that system is already in place, that Malchut is already in place, before we can move on to the second Midah. So why should this be as such? Why do we have to first set the stage and define the destination before building up to it? Anybody have any suggestions? That's what I thought also. I was hoping somebody would say that, because we always quote that from the Chadoli, which is Sof Maaseh B'Machshava Tchila. So before I heard the Shir from Rebbe, I would have answered the same thing. I mean, that's exactly the direction that I thought he was going. So, I don't know. Baruch Shekivant, to my misunderstanding. But I think that's still true. I think there's still an element here, because it's still a very important concept of Sof Maaseh B'Machshava Tchila, which means that which happens last in action is always first in thought. There's two issues with that. One is that things are much more complicated here. And two is, if that were the case, and I was thinking this out on my own, because this wasn't the direction where we went, is that we should have had David HaMelech come forth before even Abraham emerged. So, it was my initial gut reaction also, but it's not the direction that we're going to take. My Rebbe says, goes in an incredible direction and builds up something that's very powerful in context of this parasha, and incredibly halakha l'maaseh in terms of our own fixing of our own midot, of how to rule over the midot inside of our internal world. We're going to take things an entire leap forward. This means that the development of the individuals who are bringing about the midot in Klal Yisrael, or on a meta level, the formation of the midot themselves, here is the key, have to take place in the context of the seven midot as a whole, all aiming themselves at the seventh midah, the midah of Malchut. All of the midot need to emerge, need to develop, need to be produced in the context of the system of the seven midot. Not individually, not independent, but need to emerge within the context of the system of the seven midot. And that's why we need to set the stage for the seventh midah first. Because the seventh midah is defining the totality of the system. And then we can see the other midot emerge within the context of the system, not independently. Let's open that up. Without chesed, there is no system. We have chesed. Chesed wants to move on to the next midah. We say, no, before you move on, you exist in a system. And for you to expand, you need to expand not into the next midah, you need to expand into a system of midot. The foundation is chesed, like we talked about last time, even though mitzidenu, yira, and then ahava. Olam chesed ibanach, chesed is always the greater, the stronger place, the more origin place. So chesed starts off, but for chesed to then expand, it needs to expand into a system of midot.
Would that be
gevurah? What?
Would that be?
No, we're defining the end point. We're saying there are going to be seven midot, it's going to culminate in malchut, and what's about to happen needs to happen as part of a process leading to malchut. Be a part of a process of developing this system, which we've now said is going to be a system. By producing David HaMelech, or the genes for David HaMelech, we're saying, this has a goal, this has an end point. This isn't happening in a vacuum. This is happening in the context of a system. And the development of the midot must be within the context of the system of the seven midot, leading to the midah of Malchut. Let's open this up a little bit. Let's get into this, the real chomer here. Think back to what we talked about with Avraham Avinu. We said that Avraham Avinu is the Midah of Chesed. He personifies it. He embodies it. He becomes the carrier of the Midah of Chesed throughout his entire life. One part of the development of Avraham's Midah of Chesed was the eradication, the removal, the extraction of the negative elements of that Midah that existed in potential within Avraham Avinu. The negative elements of Chesed, which we drew out through Hagar in the form of Ishmael. By doing that, he made sure that this is going to come out in Ishmael as his descendant, but will not come out in Yitzchak, his descendant, and will therefore not be a critical element within the context of Klal Yisrael. What did we say was, what does it mean when we say the negative elements of Chesed? So we defined at the time that the negative elements of Chesed mean the extreme elements of Chesed. The extreme or unbalanced Chesed is negative Chesed. That's why we saw the extreme of Chesed manifest in Yishmael in the forms of theft, trespassing, arayot, him being an archer, znut, all of the things that we discussed in our shir on Yishmael. He is the embodiment of the extreme, unhealthy, and destructive elements of this midah, manifesting themselves in Yishmael in this negative form. Let's tweak this a little bit. It's not even tweaking it. We're just using other words to describe the same thing, but other words that bring out a whole new facet of what we're talking about. Which means that another way to talk about the extreme of the midah of Chesed in Yishmael, and here's where we're just going to shift our focus, same definition but shift the focus. The extreme of the midah of Chesed in Yishmael is to say that it is unwilling to incorporate into it the opposite midah of Gevurah. If negative chesed is extreme, unbalanced chesed, it's a chesed that is unwilling to incorporate into it the opposing midah of gevurah. which imposes borders, boundaries, limits. All the things we talked about that are essential to the Midah of Gvura. Yishmael having no boundaries means that his Midah is unwilling to incorporate into it or to take into consideration the existence of another Midah at the opposite end of the spectrum. That Midah is the Midah of Yitzchak. And then once Yishmael is selected away, we then have room for the Midah of Yitzchak to emerge. What this means is that once we do remove this negative element out of the system, now that the Midah of Chesed that does remain in Avraham Avinu and Klal Yisrael for all future generations, this Midah of Chesed is now a Chesed mitukan. It's in its fixed state. It's in its corrected state. It's in its proper state. It's a Chesed with no negative element left within it. What Chesed mitukan means is that despite its own nature of Chesed, it takes into consideration and is willing to give space and room for the opposite Midah of Gvura. To phrase it differently, the Midah of Chesed is willing to face the Midah of Gvura, to work along with it, not against it. It doesn't see the Midah of Gvura as clashing with it. Opposites don't have to contradict one another. Opposites can complement one another. That's the chiddush here. That while chesed is defined as going beyond one's limits and boundaries, the tendency of anything to go beyond its boundaries, and gvur is the opposite, the tendency of anything to remain within its boundaries, while those two things are totally opposite, on the opposite sides of the Midah spectrum, opposite definitions, they don't have to contradict each other. The two elements can complement each other. That's halacha l'maaseh for all of us. The diversity of Midah within us don't need to oppose each other. They need to be willing to face each other, to give each other space, to balance each other out. That's what it means to be an Adam Shalem, an Adam Mitzukan. We shouldn't feel our different elements of ourselves at war with one another. Our Chesed shouldn't be at war with our Gvura. That's when we haven't refined ourselves yet. If we have an urge that comes up to want to do something that we know we shouldn't do and we force it down, Ezu Gibora Kobeshet Yitro. That means that our chesed is not a chesed mitukan yet. So it's Baruch Hashem, we're utilizing our gvura to keep our chesed in check. But they're not necessarily meant to be kept in check, they're meant to be working with each other, facing each other. That we're actively utilizing our chesed in a positive way when we want to use it, and then actively utilizing our gvura when we want to use it. Not connect each other, but with each other. They don't have to contradict. They can complement. In terms of the individuals who bring out these midot, this means that Avraham and Yitzchak, despite how opposing their orientations may be in terms of their midot, they come to work together, come to work in balance with one another. Bringing everything full circle. This is why we need to skip ahead to the end of the process where all midot are completed and are completely working together in the context of Malchut. We need to do that before Yitzchak's even born. We need to jump ahead to Malchut. We still need to define Malchut much better. But the peripherally way, that's not English, but I'm too tired to figure it out. The way too early on definition, the insufficient definition that we gave to Malchut in this year on the Sefirot. Does anybody remember? Because we didn't focus on Malchut so much. Remember how we define Malchut? We said that it's not one of the parts of the body, but somehow it's the vessel that holds all the other midot. Somehow the Midah of Malchut is the Midah of containing, or if you will, harmonizing all of the Midot. That's part of what it is, as we'll continue to develop over our Shirim. But that that midah needs to manifest, that seventh midah needs to manifest before Yitzchak can be born. This means that all of the midot are, again, are developing in the context of the entire system of midot. No midah is being formed as an individual midah independent of itself. From the beginning of their formation, they are being formed as interactive midot, complementary midot, harmonized midot. Again, this comes back to issues that are on the Atzmo and the concept of Tikkun HaMidot. When we experience internally, we experience our Midot in a way where they're all working together. Where we feel more and more a sense of harmony between the different aspects of ourselves and less internal clashes inside of ourselves. There shouldn't be any clash between our Midot. They should be working in harmony with one another. That's what it means to have an internal reality of shalom and to have the midah of malchut inside of ourselves. That's what it means to be an adam mitukan. Limashal, let's say you're teaching somebody to become a professional violinist and you want them to be able to play in a symphony orchestra. You're not just going to teach them how to play the violin. What are you going to teach them? How to play well, good. So we want them to excel at playing the violin. How do you play within the orchestra? How do you play within the orchestra? If you can have the most excellent, most skilled violinist in the world, but if they sit down with the other 50 people in the orchestra and they can't play well with others, they're never getting a job because they're not truly a violinist. That's the chah. That's not what it takes to become an exceptional violinist. It's not just the ability to play on your own, but the ability to work within the context of that orchestra, to provide harmony, to at certain times step up and take the forefront, and at other times step back and provide the harmony that allows for the beauty of that symphony to take place. It's an incredible thing. It's an incredible thing. It's in my notes, this happened recently, just to share one quick story. I had a really cool opportunity to go to the Israeli Philharmonic Orchestra a couple of weeks ago, which was super fun at Carnegie Hall. And Yitzchak Perlman was there and played with them. So the first half I was like, oh, and I knew that these shirim were coming up and this was on my mind because obviously we're thinking about these shirim when we're watching a symphony orchestra, right? That's what we're all going to do when we go forward. So I'm watching for the first until the intermission and I was like, oh, this is nice. And I'm like trying to like add meaning to it and I wasn't like so, honestly, I wasn't so particularly moved. After the intermission, they bring out Yitzchak Perlman. And he's an older man now and he never walks so well. He has physical issues. And he very, with great pains, walked onto the stage. They put him on a stage, I think, just because he was the centerpiece of the orchestra. And they wanted to raise him up, literally, so he would be at standing height with the other viola player who was playing with him. And it was not, this is in no way negative towards the Israeli Philharmonic. They're wonderful. They were really a very spectacular orchestra, from the little bit that I understand about classical music. But the experience of watching him play, and with all due respect, the experience of watching him play on the contrasting background of one of the most skilled orchestras in the world was totally different. Everybody else is like, really, they're very focused. When it's their turn to play, their arms straighten out, they focus, they go in, they come out, because they know how to work within the context of an orchestra. You watch, I was sitting there watching Yitzchak Perlman sit there, and he's not tense, he's like water. He's just like water. He's got his violin sitting there on his neck, not even holding it. He's just swaying back and forth. And he's living with the rest of the music when he's not playing. And then the moment that his opportunity comes in for him to have a solo, and most of the piece, and they obviously chose a piece where there was going to be a lot of violin solos. There was no sense of tense, get ready, go. He's just flowing and his hand just flows and it just suddenly touches the violin and suddenly the music just appears. And I sat there thinking to myself, like, That's a violinist mitukan, if you will. That's what that means. A person who has total mastery over that instrument in the way where he doesn't feel any lack when he's not playing. He's not swaying with the music like we sway at a Kumsitz. He's living in the music when he's not playing, because that's just as alive for him as the violinist is when he's not playing. And the moment that he comes and takes center stage, it doesn't matter. He was always, you could see there was no, he didn't change. He was always the violinist. And sometimes the violinist was, its part was to be quiet, and sometimes it was to be, it was to literally be the only one playing. Sorry to have stretched out the example, but I've been holding on to this for a couple of weeks. This is like, having talked about it more, it had a very big impact on me, watching him play. But that's what we're talking about here, taking it, it's not, I'm going to say lehefech, it's beautiful, music is beautiful, music is part of Torah also. But to move it back into the realms of definitive Kiddusha, right? To move it into the realm of the Midot, that's what we're talking about. That it shouldn't be our Midah of Chesed versus our Midah of Gevura. That David HaMelech comes out first. The Midah of Malchut comes out first to show us that when the Midot develop, when they emerge, they need to emerge in the context of the system, of the symphony of the Midot. That for those Midot to come out in a way that's mitukan, they're coming out in that system, understanding that they're going to have to face their opposites, work with their opposites, and harmonize each other to create the beautiful music that is the symphony of the seven Midot. That's an Adam Mitukan, and that's how the Midot present themselves in their Mitukan form. Only coming out once they're in the context of the seven. I'm going to take a question. We're about to then now shift it and plug all of this into the structure of our Parsha, and split our Parsha. Before that, we'll take the question. Yeah. I don't know how my Rebbe got away with not explaining it up until now, so we'll just do it. That's what Malchut is all about. That's the essence of the Midah of Malchut. How do we define Malchut in English?
Kingship.
Kingship is owned by a king, or a leader, or a president, or whatever you want. Let's use a democratic system. Okay? Let's use a democratic system. Let's say that we're electing a president. There should be no overtones here of any of the incredibly charged political state of reality of our country as it stands right now. I would have said the same thing 4 years ago. I would have said it 4 years before that. It's all the same. Nothing has changed. And nothing is different here or anywhere else in the world for that matter. When we decide that we want to elect a president, different people come forth and say, I'm going to do such and such. I believe this. I want to do this. I want to accomplish this. This is my value system. This is what I want. And their goal is their hope is that the majority of the people in that place will agree with that person's worldview and elect them to then go forward and implement their personal agenda. I mean, that's not even skewing things. That's just definitionally what an election is. Is that fair to say? So the same thing by a king. Now, by a king, it's different. There's no democratic system if it's a real king. They're born into it, but therefore you hope for a good king, because what are they going to do? They're going to implement their agenda. Their agenda could be world peace. Their agenda could be genocide. It depends on their parents and how they were raised. And you have to just kind of daven really hard that it works out, that the next king is going to be great. But it's the same thing. There's just no democratic process involved. All of those paradigms are anti the Jewish understanding of what it means to be a melech, of what Malchut is really about. Malchut is mamash the exact opposite. Al pi kavala, Malchut is defined as...
phrases late, lay, megarme, klum.
Late, lay, megarme, klum. It has nothing of its own. It has nothing of its own. That's Malchut. What's the Jewish definition of a king, of true kingship? A person who has worked on themselves to such an extent, late, lay, megarme, klum. A person who has worked on themselves to such an extent, they've cleared out all of their personal agendas, all of their personal issues, all of their worldview, and made themselves a what? What's our key word that we keep using in the concept of Malchut? A vessel, or in Hebrew? A kli. A melech is the ultimate kli. What is that melech a kli for? What makes them a melech? They're a kli for malchut shamayim. That's what validates them being a melech. Is that they're able to bring within them HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Malchut Shemayim, and be that which expresses Malchut Shemayim in the world. How does HaKadosh Baruch Hu interact with us? Through what? Through what? Use our terms. Stick to our shirim. How does HaKadosh Baruch Hu interact with us? What? Through the Midot. So therefore, by definition, if a melech is going to be the expression of God's malchus in this world, what does he have to contain within him? All the ways in which HaKadosh Baruch Hu is intending himself to interact with the world, which is the Midot. Which means the goal of malchus is to contain all of the Midot, be a kli that holds all the Midot, and what's the word that we're adding in our shiur? Harmonizes all the Midot. A melech in reflecting Malchut Shemayim is going to have to contain all of the Midot and harmonize all of the Midot. To be a complete reflection of Malchut Shemayim in a way of Shalom. And that's David HaMelech. That's who he is. David HaMelech takes everything out. Pushes everything aside. His whole focus is to be Neved Hashem. One of the most beautiful stories that brings it out, and I want to come back because we still have a few more things to do, and like I said, the chances of finishing on time are slim to none. But one of the most beautiful stories that brings this out is the fact that when the Aron needs to get to Yerushalayim, anybody familiar with the story? We've quoted it in the past. What does David HaMelech do in order to get to the Aron to Yerushalayim? He doesn't just dance. He dances. He dances his heart out. It's in the psukim. It's emphasized more in the midrashim. He dances his heart out. So much so that as he's dancing like a crazy person in front of that Aron, and every time he dances, that Aron gets one step closer to Yerushalayim. Who sits there up in the palace gazing out at David HaMelech and judging him and saying, "Who do you think you are?" Who? Michal Bat Shaul. His wife, Michal Bat Shaul. And when David HaMelech comes back to the palace, what does Michal say to David HaMelech? He says, "What are you doing? You're an embarrassment. You're a king. Walk with dignity. Act with dignity. Why are you acting like one of these people?" David HaMelech, without missing a beat, looks at him and says, "No, you don't get it. That's what makes me a king. You saw the Aron move when I danced? That's what HaKadosh Baruch Hu saying, you're doing the right thing. I don't care what everybody sees. I don't care what everybody thinks. I am not bent by the will of my people. I am not an expression of the will of my people. Who am I an expression of? HaKadosh Baruch Hu." The end. The end. And that's the harmony that's necessary. For a king, there are sometimes where a king does have to stand there and does have to be regal, an expression of the Kavod Shemayim that he is. And there are times when a king has to get there and dance. You know, I was at, I don't know if I've ever told this story publicly before. I was at a wedding one time. And, I think it's the top list. I was at a wedding one time. And the father and the chassan, I was there for the chassan, I forget, there have been so many weddings in the last 6 years, who knows whose wedding it was at this point. But it was, I was there for the chassan, for sure. I mean, there was a wedding where I was there for the chassan. And he took his father's hand at the chassan's tish, or his father took his hand, and they started dancing like crazy during the chassan's tish. And I was like, "I'm here to support the chassan, and nobody's getting in on it," so I jumped in. And I grabbed the father's hand, and I started dancing with the chassan. And the chassan's father was so happy, and the chassan was so happy, and I'm just dancing my heart out, because why did I come? Why was it the wedding? That's why I was there! And I remember for a lot of other reasons that I'm not going to say publicly, but I remember the Masadar Kedushin, who was sitting there filling out either the Tanayim or the Ketubah at that point, looking around to me, he grabs my arm, and looks at me and he says, "Keep dancing like that, and I'm going to say your pasul edus, and you're not signing this ketubah." He's Masadar Kedushin, and I sat down. That's a person, with all due respect, and I don't believe he deserves any respect, no one knows who he is, so it's fine, I don't think he deserves any respect, very well-known rabbi in the New York, New Jersey area. doesn't reserve any respect. That's a person who's not an Adama Tukan. That's a person who doesn't understand David HaMelech. There isn't Hasidim versus Misnagdim. And I'm not a Hasid anyway. I'm not a Misnagd either. I'm a Jew. I'm an Eved Hashem. That's my goal. My goal is to start to be an Eved Hashem. That's it. And there's a time to dance. And there are times not to dance. But a wedding is time to dance. And if you miss a man, it's time to dance. Yeah, you have to recognize that there's a broader scope to reality. And the goal is, what's my Avodas Hashem in this moment? And we see people who see other people, and they wave them off. Like, these people are dancing, they must be Hasidim, or they're Neo-Hasidim, whatever that means. Lord knows what that means. Right? They're just, if the question is, are they dancing because they're Ovdei Hashem, or are they not dancing because that's not the Avodas Hashem? Lehefek, I'll give you a story on the other side. There is, I don't necessarily agree with him, but I respect him. There's an amazing Rav. He's a Rav in one of the yeshivas in Israel. And I was on a summer program with him. And every Shabbos, I was on I don't want to give too many details to not identify the individual, but I was on a Shabbos experience with him, and it was very clear that he was dafka not dancing during Kabbalah Shabbos, which was surprising to me because he's an emistic Oved Hashem, and the whole place was dancing, and also, like, you want to inspire the kids, like, what are you doing sitting down? So, as you all know, because I tell these kind of stories to you in all different formats, I have no sense of busha or chutzpah or whatever it is. I just go and ask people things. So I walked up to him and I said, because we had an open conversation relationship, I said, I'm really curious. You're a thoughtful person. You're clearly trying to make a statement by not dancing. What statement are you making by not dancing during Lech HaDodi, during Kabbalah Shabbos? And he said, because I don't think people understand what Kabbalah Shabbos is. I said, what do you mean? He said, well, Kabbalah Shabbos is leading up to Yimot HaMashiach. The whole idea is that Shabbos embodies Mashiach. And when we're talking about the things that are leading up to Mashiach, there are going to be horribly frightening wars, and death, and Tchiyat HaMeitim, and it's going to be a really difficult, painful, frightening process. And I'm not in a place where I think that I'm ready to dance about that yet. I haven't gotten there internally yet. Now again, do I agree with him? No, I'm still dancing during Kabbalah Shabbos. Not to worry, I'm still dancing during Kabbalah Shabbos. But that's, I respect that. That's a person who says, no, I believe that this generation doesn't understand what it's saying, and I'm trying to make a point, which is that, do you understand that what's happening right now with the movement from Friday to Shabbos is the movement from the 6,000 years to the 7,000 years? Do you understand that? Do you understand what comes along with that? Do you understand what the war of Gog and Magog is? Do you understand what Tchiyat HaMeitim is? Do you understand that? Says this Rav, who's very intense. But that's a meaningful question. I have tremendous respect for that. Even it didn't stop me from dancing, but I have tremendous respect for that. That's an individual who's owning their midot. That's what Malchus is. Malchus is sitting and being the only one on the side, if you believe that's what a Kaddish Baruch wants. It's standing up and being the only one dancing with it. But it doesn't matter what you're doing, it matters what's inside of you. Are you an Adam Mitukan or are you not? And an Adam Mitukan is somebody who lives with the midot of Malchut. And the only way you can live with the midah malchut properly is if you've been metakin all of your midot and are living with all of the midot in harmony. And after that very, very long tangent, coming back, and let's plug all that back into what we just said. I'm just restating what we said probably 10 minutes ago. Is that's the point here. All of the midot must evolve, must develop within the context of the system of the midot. They're not independent. None of them are developing in a void. They must develop in the context of the midot, and that's... Now let's go back to our parsha. This was the Vayir Shira one. Let's go back to our parsha. You ready? Finally, the Malach comes and says, Avram, Sarah, you're going to have a child. And his name is going to be Yitzchak. 1 year from today, you're going to have Yitzchak. The next thing that happens is... What's the next thing that happens?
Stone.
What part of stone? What part of the story of stone? What happens immediately following that? Nope. Don't skip part of the story. What happens between the telling of the coming of Yitzchak and the actual destruction of stone? We're down to two humashim. Look inside. What happens? Abraham pleads with the Kadosh Baruch Hu not to destroy stone. Now let's take a look at those psukim and understand what's happening over here. Perak Yudchet Pasuk Tet Zayin, I put it on your source sheets because I'm going to keep embarrassing you. You're going to be a humashim. Your source sheet, source number one. Let's go. Vayakumu misham ha'anashim. Vayashkifu al pnei stone. So two of the malachim went, and they go and they gaze out over stone. Again, this concept of vayishkof, gazing back to vayira, this word in its various forms and various ways of playing out is underlying the entire parsha. Va'avraham olech imam l'shalcham. And Avraham goes with them to send them off. Va'ashem amar. Then God says, and like, do what we said to do in Lech Lecha, pretend you're reading this for the first time, and then think about how weird this is. Okay? Va'ashem amar. God says to whom? No, to himself. God's like, okay, now I'm going to tell you what I was thinking at the time. That's a thing that almost never happens in Torah. It does happen a bunch of times. It very rarely happens in Torah. God says, here's what I'm thinking. Am I really going to hide from Avram what I'm going to do? I'll ask you a better question. Does he always tell Avram what he's going to do? No, lots of stuff is happening and he's not telling Avram. What does that mean? Am I going to hide from Avram that which I'm going to do? For Avraham, oh yeah, the goy gadol v'atzum, and Avraham's going to be a tremendous nation, and I'm going to bless the whole world through him. Ki dati, for I know him, leman asher yitzaveh benav, that beito acharav, v'shamru derech Hashem, la'asot staka u'mishvat, leman hevi Hashem al Avraham, et asher diber alav. In order to tell his children and his household, and to keep the derech of Hashem, and to do staka, and to do mishvat, in order to bring about Avraham everything that I say. Okay, so now I have to tell Avraham. Whatever that means. So he does. He comes to Avraham and says, I'm going to destroy stone. I hear the cries of stone that are tremendous and their sins and they're very heavy against me. If it's really true and they are crying out to me, I'm going to destroy stone, if that's really who they are, these people who are just torturing other people, I'm going to destroy them. And it's not that I won't, but everybody knows where this is headed. It's stone we're talking about. Stone doesn't stand a chance. Having heard this, the Malachim seemingly having understood this, because the Malachim were standing next to Avram, although they already knew it because they're Malachim. But the Malachim having heard this, which is basically God signaling, off you go, time to destroy Sodoma and Gomorrah. But Avram doesn't move. He's like, whoa, we're not going forward so fast. I'm standing my ground here. Vayigash Avraham, and so Avraham steps forward towards HaKadosh Baruch Hu, which many understand in Tefillah, that Hagasha is the Lashon of Tefillah. He approaches HaKadosh Baruch Hu. We take three steps forward and we start Shemoneh Esrei. HaKadosh Baruch Hu, excuse me, Avraham approaches HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Vayomer, Ha'af Tispet Tzadikim Rasha, are you going to destroy the Tzadik with the Rasha? Ula Yesh Chamishim Tzadikim B'toch Ha'ir. Maybe there are 50 tzaddikim in the city. Ha'af tispeh v'lo tisa l'makom l'imkom l'man 50 tzaddikim asher b'kivo chalila l'cha me'asot k'davar hazeh. It's Achil Hashem, basically, saying to God, who gets to define what is and is not Achil Hashem, it's a chalila l'cha to do this thing, which is what? L'hamit tzaddikim rasha, to kill the righteous with the wicked. V'ayak tzaddik rasha, to treat the righteous like the wicked. Chalila l'cha. Hashofet kol ha'aretz lo yasa mishpat, that the judge of the earth shouldn't do mishpat. Now this whole thing is very weird. God's like, I'm going to destroy stone. Should probably tell Avram. Okay. Then he does. And then what does Avram do? Argue with him. Does Avram win? No, Avram loses anyway. So then we have another 10 psukim, what's already a very long parsha, of them arguing about it, and then Avram loses the fight anyway. What's being brought out here? What's the purpose of this conversation? Think about the words of Avraham. What is Avraham fighting for?
Mercy, justice.
Good. No, he's not. Lot doesn't come up here. Lot's not said explicitly here at all. What was the word you use? Not really mercy. He's not saying they're evil and let them go anyway. He's asking for something very specific, which brings me finally back to here, which is
justice.
What's the word that's used in the psukim? Tzedek and mishpat. What midah are tzedek and mishpat linked to? Nope. Gvura. Gvura. Din. Gvura is all about, what do we say gvura is all about? Staying within your borders and boundaries. Law itself, the system of law, the whole goal of laws is to create borders and boundaries. This is
okay.
If you violate the law and go outside of this box of things which are allowed, that's not okay. Mishpat, din, are associated with the midah of gvura. Which name of HaKadosh Baruch Hu is associated with the midah of gvura?
Excellent. Elohim.
But I don't have to say Elohim, because if I have a different intent, I could say the word Elohim. Why can I say the word Elohim? What is an Elohim? An Elohim. Nope. No, then we could have to say Elohim. What is an Elohim? Is a judge. If you look through Tanakh, it uses the word Elohim to mean a judge. What's the connection between the two? Because Elohim is the expression of God in this world, working within the boundaries of nature, the laws of nature, or the aspect of Din of HaKadosh Baruch Hu when he follows through on his attribute of Din and justice and Mishpat. Who is fighting for Mishpat here? Who's fighting for Din here? Avraham. But what's his midah? What's going on? Avram's fighting for Din? Ha'af, tispet, tzadikim rasha, vayaka, tzadik v'rasha. That's not mishpat. That's what Avram's fighting for. He's fighting for justice. He's fighting for mishpat. He's fighting for Din. What does this story bring out in Avraham? The recognition that there needs to be a counterbalancing midah. God says you're going to have Yitzchak, but before you can have Yitzchak, you need to understand Yitzchak isn't separate. It's not additional. Yitzchak is his own midah, but you now see Avraham literally calling about for the revelation, for the emergence of the midah of Din, the midah of Gvura. And so the two come hand in hand, because the midah of Gvura, which was just announced, needs to be recognized by Avraham as emerging, as an important piece that's a necessary component of reality. And how do we then deal with the counterbalance of Avraham being chesed, but recognizing that there needs to be din? What gives us the means to understand how that's going to happen? The salvation of Lot in the story of Sodom. And that's why all of these are one eon. All three of these are one. It's all one long paragraph. The announcing of Yitzchak comes along with Avram recognizing that he needs a counterbalancing midah, and the way that that's going to work and not be contradictory but complementary is through the production of the beginnings of Lot and Moab and David. That gives it a system and a kli in which to exist where they can all be harmonized. Then we come to Avimelech. Now, we're going to not do justice to Avimelech, because next year on Monday we're going to just talk about Avimelech, who is the king of who? Grar. Part of which empire? Yes! Win. Learn from your first year students, right? From the Plishtim. So we'll get into Avimelech and the Plishtim. That's going to be the topic of Shir on Monday. But to just touch on certain elements that we're not going to talk about on Monday. Even in the context of that story, it struck me as I was reading it. It was Stein Mikra also last week, so I was going back and looking at it with fresh eyes. Every time we read it, we've got to read with fresh eyes. It jumped out at me. When Avram goes to Avimelech, he says, "Sarah is my
sister."
That was really the first 27 years away. Good. Sarah's my sister. And then Avimelech comes to him after God's like, "What are you doing?" And I was like, "I don't know. What am I doing?" He's like, "You took Sarah, Avram's wife." He's like, "Whoa! Avram said sister, not wife. I was paying attention. I don't know what you're talking about. Leave me alone." And God says, "You better give her back." And then Avram is attacked by Avimelech. "What are you doing to me?" And that's the beginning of source number 2, because you all don't have Klamashim. Source number 2, which is Bereishit Perekhaf Pasuk Tet. Avimelech comes and confronts Avram and says, "What are you doing? This is not how you're supposed to act." Pasuk Yud. Vayomer Avimelech Avraham. Ma ra'ita ki yasita davar zeh. Ma ra'ita, Parshat Vayira. What did you see that you did this thing to me, that you didn't tell me she was your wife? Look at Avram's answer. Again, this isn't even going to be what we're talking about when we talk about the whole story next time. Vayomer Avraham, ki amarti rak ein yirat Elokim. There's no yirah here. There's no yirat Elokim. Elokim midat hadin. Yira is the midah of yira gvura. Avram recognizing that if there's no yirat Elokim, it's a dangerous place. Maribi didn't point that out, but to me it screams out from that story. This is again Avraham now internalizing. Not only should God act with this midah, that we need this midah, he's saying if this midah doesn't exist, there are going to be problems. And with all of that in place, then we can finally have the birth of Yitzchak. Now when we have the birth of Yitzchak, it's not just that we're talking about who is... This is also of my own. This is not my Rebbe's, but I think to me I was just following through the parsha. Once we have the birth of Yitzchak, it's not just the separating out of Yishmael, because we have to pick between the two children. Why is Yishmael now, by definition, pushed out? It's not just chosen versus not chosen. What is Yishmael? But how do we now reformulate that? What was our other take on it in this context of this year? It's chesed that is unable to face or coexist with Gvura. So the moment that Yitzchak is born, by default, Yishmael has no place. And of course he doesn't get along with Yitzchak. And of course he can't coexist with Yitzchak. Because Yishmael's extreme chesed in a way where it can't harmonize and work with another midah. And so Yishmael has to leave the scene. That's why he didn't leave in Parshat Lech Lecha in my mind. Once Yishmael comes about in the context of this discussion of midot harmonizing, that's the moment that Yishmael immediately leaves the scene. Skip on Melech 2 for a second. Then we go to Akedat Yitzchak. Now let's read Akedat Yitzchak. Last time you read it from whose perspective? Yitzchak's perspective. Let's read it this time from Avram's perspective and watch beautifully how it's woven in these pesukim, and with this we'll conclude. Source number 3. Pesukim that are familiar to us, the story of Akedat Yitzchak, but pay attention to the nuances of the words here. Vayihi achar hadvarim ha'ele, perachav bet pasuk aleph. Vayihi achar hadvarim ha'ele. Who tests Avraham? Elohim. Now it's not just do you dignify the importance of another midah. Now the God of judgment, or rather God showing his face of judgment, interacting with the world through his midah of Gvura or Din, through the face of Elohim. That's the God that's testing Avram. That's the way that God is coming into the world, the way he's reflected in the world as he tests Avram. Can you really coexist with Gvura? And Avram goes, and he takes Yitzchak, and he takes the Ne'arim, and they go and they travel to the Makom. And they say that they're going to go up the mountain, Pasuk Vav. And this is a phrase which we mentioned last time is emphasized again and again and again. Vayikach Avraham Atzei Ha'ola Vayasem Al Yitzchak Beno. He takes the Atzei Ola. He takes the wood. Thank you. He takes the wood. And he puts it on his back. Sorry, he puts it on Yitzchak. And he takes the fire and he takes the fire pan. And what's the end of that sentence? What's the end of that pasuk? Vayalchu Shnehem Yachtav. And one layer of what it means that it keeps emphasizing this parsha, Vayalchu Shnehem Yachtav, Vayalchu Shnehem Yachtav. The pasuk chet, the end of the pasuk again, Vayalchu Shnehem Yachtav. I underlined it again. Is that Avraham recognizes that in order to succeed in the test of the Akedah, which is not a test of chesed, it's a test of Gvura. A negative expression of Gvura is going to be murder. To stop a life, to end a life, to cut short a life. Killing, murder is a negative expression of Gvura. For Avraham to exist in the context of Gvura, what does Avraham recognize? What does he need? What does he need?
Balance.
And And literally, what does he need in the story? He needs Yitzchak. Which, according to some svarim, is one, another layer of the meaning of Akedat Yitzchak. It's not the binding of Yitzchak to the Mizbeach, but rather, can Avraham bind himself to Yitzchak? Akedat Yitzchak. Is he able to bind himself to Yitzchak? Can he truly turn and face and harmonize himself and utilize the Midah of Yitzchak? Can they really walk together? Can they really do this together? And Avram goes and succeeds and lifts up the knife to shecht his son, Pasuk Yud Aleph. Vayikrai lav malach Hashem min ha-shamayim, vayomer Avraham, Avraham, vayomer hineni. And a malach Hashem calls out from Shemayim and says, Avram, Avram, he says, I'm here. Pasuk Yud Bet. Vayomer, the malach says, Al tishlach yadcha al ha-na'ar, don't extend your hand to the boy. Val ta'aslo mi'ma, don't do anything to him. Why? Ki atai yadati, hear the words. Ki atai yadati, now I know. Only now and now I know. Ki rei Elokim ata. This proved that you're not just an Ohev Hashem, but you're Yirei Elokim. That you have harmony, you have balance. That's why this is the 10th test of Abraham. This isn't just about bringing out the inherent, innate qualities of Abraham, of Chesed, of Ahava. If I tell you to, can you be Gvura? If I tell you to, can you balance yourself in a way that's totally analogous to you if it's for me, says God? And the answer was always yes, it's Avram we were talking about. But as the Ramban points out, this is all to bring it out, mikoach alapoel, to bring it from potential to actual. Now you've actualized not just the infinite ahava that you have, you've actualized that you're also a Yirei Elokim. The Midah of Yira, the Midah of Gvura, in the context of Elokim. It's literally the psukim. I wonder how you not read this way. That's the response of the Malach. Now I know you're Yirei Elokim. And Avram goes and he brings an isle instead of Yitzchak, Pasuk Yedaled. Again, remember the name of the parsha is Vayera. Vayikra v'ham shem baku Hashem Yir'eh. Asher yomar hayom behar Hashem Yira'eh. Focus on Yir'at Hashem. The midah of Gevura, clarity of what a Kadosh Baruch Hu is being at a distance. And then finally, the concluding pasuk of the paragraph, and basically the end of the parsha. Pasuk Yotet, reading it the classic way, where both Avram and Yitzchak then descend the mountain together. Vayashav Avraham al ne'arav, Avraham, again, parentheses, and Yitzchak go down, back to the ne'arim who were there. Vayakumu vayachu yachtav. And it sounds like, I want to emphasize the word, yachtav. But I don't! Because the pasuk continues. Where are they going? He comes down and they walk together to where? Vayachu yachtav el Be'er Shava. Why would that be important that they end up going towards Be'er Shava, walking towards Be'er Sheva? What might that be an embodiment of? The Midot themselves, the seven Midot. Walking towards the sense of completion of the seven Midot. Which is why before we go to Akedat Yitzchak, what do we establish right beforehand in part 4 of this Parsha? We establish the reality of Be'er Shava. Abraham creates a reality of Be'er Shava. The fact that there are going to be wells dug and new water drawn forth that are going to continue to be drawn forth until we get to David HaMelech, until we get to the seventh Midah. And so the Parsha closes with Avraham and the next stage Yitzchak united together, walking towards the totality and conclusion of the system, Be'er Shava, the conclusion of that entire system in the context of the seven Midot. Well, we had one last piece. I know I'm over time, but I warned you that I was going to go over time because I'm tired, so I can't. You know, whatever. Right? So, my Rebbe always quoted the following midrash. A midrash which you've all seen. because he quotes it a lot at the end of Noah and a lot at the beginning of Lech Lecha. But as you know, because I keep emphasizing it, I just see it inside. So this summer I tracked it down. And when I saw it, I almost fell off my seat because it's amazing. This is why when somebody quotes something to you, say, I want to see it inside. Because the Medrash that he quotes has an end which he doesn't quote. And I think it's really important. What's that Medrash? The Medrash that started everything off, which literally now and globally brings our Lech Lecha Vayir Shirim literally full circle. What started our Lech Lecha Shirim was the concept that HaKadosh Baruch Hu searched for 10 generations sifted through the sands of the history of humankind in order to find who? Avram Avinu. That's source number 4. The same Medrash that's been on previous source sheets. Rabbi Brechia B'Shem Rabbi Nachami Omar Lemelech. It's a mashal to a melech who goes from place to place, and a margalit, a jewel falls from his crown. The melech goes and they sift through until finally they find it. Amro Matzah HaMelech Margalit Shelo. The king found his pearl. Kach Amar HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Matzorech Hayali Liachis Shem Arpachshad Shlach Eiver Peleg Reu Sirub Nachor Terah. That's a lot of time. That's a lot of psukim. That's a lot of extra time in shul. Why are we going through all of this? It's worth it. Says HaKadosh Baruch Hu Ela Bishvilcha. It was worth it to sift and sift and sift through the sands of history to get to you, Abraham. I found you as Ne'eman, the most faithful to me. I found Abraham. It was worth going through all of that to sift through the sands of history to get to you. There's the last line of the Medrash. See why I'm so excited? Do you get it? Do you see it? Let's read it together. Ka, so too, meaning there's a parallel being made here in the Medrash. Kach Amar HaKadosh Baruch Hu to whom? L'David. What's David doing in this Medrash? Because he has everything to do with this process. Kach Amar HaKadosh Baruch Hu l'David. Matzorech hayo l'acheis Peretz, Katron, Ram, Aminadav, Nachshon, Shalmon, Boaz, Oved, Yishai, David. Lo bil shvilcha, is it not for you? Rhetorical question, meaning it is for you. It was all for you, David. To draw you out. Why is the Medrash that defines sifting through the sands of time to find Abraham the same Medrash that emphasizes the necessity of sifting through the sands of time to find David? Why? You tell me. Somebody stop writing and take notes and tell me. No. Say better. Because I could just be crazy. Why is the Medrash that's telling us the importance of sitting to the sands of history to find Abraham the same Medrash that somehow now randomly tells us the importance of sifting through the sands of history to find David? Because it's the beginning and end of one process, and deeper than that, because Abraham can only emerge and develop and go forth if it's in the context of whom? Of David HaMelech. Because Abraham, the depth, the full meaning of Avraham and his Midah is only in the context of David and his Midah. So much so that when the Medrash talks about the importance of sifting through all of humanity to find Avraham, it's side by side in the same Medrash with finding David HaMelech. And then bringing it right back to our Parsha, which is why I put these sources on the back of the sheet. What's the pasuk that the Medrash quotes? Among Torah! Matzati David Avdi, which is the same pasuk that the other Medrash quoted. Where did he find David Avdi? In stone. The same pasuk. Because it's all that inyan. That pasuk is hinting to the fact that that's the inyan that we're talking about. Matzati David Avdi, Hechan Mitzatif B'Stom. Now that we've completed all of this and gone radically over time, we didn't put on the last part of the Parsha. What's number 6? The birth of Rivka. Why is the birth of Rivka here? Why are we ending with the birth of Rivka? She's an indication of what?
The cycle, because she produces Yaakov.
So two things. One is, now that we've gotten to this point, we've concluded really Avraham's place. We've concluded the issues of the Midah of Chesed. And move on to the Midah of Gvura. So now that Yitzchak becomes Yitzchak, and only once Yitzchak becomes Yitzchak, we can now focus on the other half of his neshama. Now there is a Rivka. If Rivka had come about before Yitzchak fully became Yitzchak, they wouldn't have gotten married. They couldn't have gotten married. If we weren't wildly oversensitive, incredibly important point with regards to dating. You need to be who you need to be in order to find the other half of your soul. If your half isn't where it needs to be yet, it's not going to fit into the other half of the other person you're looking for. But now that Yitzchak is Yitzchak, now we can have Rivka, because the two go together. And even deeper than that, and without getting into the sources, you can take my word for this, just good. So now the next generation will look up this source somewhere. Great. Which is that, what is the Midah of Yitzchak? So what is Yitzchak going to need in the context of his marriage and his life? The Midah of
Chesed.
And now that we understand that those need to go hand in hand, now we also that Rivka is produced, who she herself embodies Chesed, because now we can comprehend, we can internalize the concept that Chesed and Gvura can unite, can merge, can become one, can face each other, can complement each other. Because that's all that Rivka is. Rivka is Chesed. How does Eliezer find Rivka?
Yes.
Who's going to do an overflowing of chesed and stop me and give me water and give my camels water and be a complete, pure chesed? The emergence of Rivka is in the aftermath of that. It's the epilogue to this story. It shows that Yitzchak's now fully come out as Gvura, and so we can meet his other half, and that we can embrace that his other half is chesed. Because the two are meant to go together, to complement each other, to work with each other. And so now we're ready to embark onto the next parsha, onto Chayisara, and discuss really the closing out of Avram's life, which is somehow weirdly intermingled with the search for Rivka. That's what we would do on, I don't know what day of the week it is. So it's, I keep saying Wednesday because I don't know what day of the week it is. On Monday, that's what we would do, but we do have more left. I don't want to miss the opportunity to talk about the significance of Avimelech and the significance of the nation of the Plishtim here and throughout all of Tanakh. So we're going to do that. But remember this thread, because this is what we're going to pick up with and start off our discussion of Chayisara in two shiurim from now, after we complete the Parsha next week, by exploring the genetic origins and the playing out over the course of Jewish history of the Plishtim, Bezrat Hashem, on Monday.